Hey, it's Francis Lamb, host of The Splendid Table. Every week on our show, we talk about food and cooking and the meanings of food and cooking. We talk with the most interesting people in food about their techniques, their culture, and everything in between. Whether it's about how fried chicken took over the world or how Instagram changes the way people are actually eating. It's a food show where everyone is welcome. Come join us. You can listen to The Splendid Table wherever you get your podcasts.
Bonnie knows when you plant something, it keeps on giving. Growing from friend to neighbor to community. Generations of gardeners have trusted Bonnie for fresh, healthy vegetable and herb plants. Rely on Bonnie for quality plants, help, and support. Bonnie, gardening with you since 1918. BonniePlants.com.
I was a waif. I was a babe in the woods. I was a refugee. So I had to move to New York. And it was a nightmare. An absolute nightmare. I was scared to death every day. I'm still scared to death every day. Whoa. I'm Steve Jenkins. I'm one of the guys that operates the Fairway Markets in the tri-state area. I'm your guy watching out for you because all these things we sell at Fairway that you can't find anyplace else are a product of my scholarship.
HeritageRadioNetwork.org presents Evolutionaries. Steve Jenkins. Who is Steve Jenkins? He's the reason the best imported cheeses and olive oils in the world are available in New York. He's one of the guys behind the revolutionary Fairway Markets. His award-winning first book, The Cheese Primer, is in its record-breaking 11th printing and is one of the most highly regarded books in the world of cheese. He's the first American to be welcomed into France's super honorary society, Taste Fromage. He was honored with a Lifetime Achievement Award from the American Cheese Society. Steve tells it like it is. He's got no time for phonies, and above all else, he values sharing quality food with the people he loves. We sat down with Steve Jenkins, who told us how it all started and how he got it done.
I got involved in this stuff in the mid-70s when I went to work in a cheese shop simply because I needed a job and I was out of work. I was trying to be an actor and I couldn't get an acting job to save my life. I found myself in a cheese shop, working in a cheese shop. It had always struck me as being a privilege to work with those cheeses that I'd never heard of, never knew anything about them. And in those days, there really wasn't much available. But that which was available, I invested a certain amount of majesty into them. I thought it was just very cool that this stuff was made in the first place and imported to the United States in the second place and available to people on the street that just walked in a cheese shop. I just thought that was the coolest thing in the world. And I decided that I wanted to learn everything there was to know about those cheeses. I just kept learning more and more and more about how food evolved and how it's very largely a Europe phenomenon that our sensibilities, since most of us came from Europe, and we were left high and dry here in the New World with game and with whatever we could grow and whatever grain we could mill and turn into bread. And it was slim pickings for a long, long time. And as time went on, there began to be a general store where you could fill in the things that you didn't produce yourself, sugar, for instance, or coffee or tea. But everything else you made yourself or your neighbor made and you bartered. There was really no industry for people to provide a variety of foodstuffs for themselves. And diets were very meager. You know, after the war, World War II, we had so many wars, you got to name them, right? You can't just say the war. After World War II, it got to a point in America where food shopping was just not a pleasurable experience because the lady of the house did all the food shopping, never the man. And the lady of the house was confronted by the butcher shop, the bakery, the florist, the fishmonger, the dairy store, the mercantile store where she bought all her dry goods. And this was at a point where supermarkets hadn't been invented. And some guy out here, as a matter of fact, on the East Coast, Alfred Deitch, he said, why don't we all just get a big space and share the rent and put all this stuff under one roof and we'll kill everybody else. We'll just kill them. Our rents will be lower. Our costs, therefore, will be lower. If we do it together, we'll all share in that benefit. And by golly, that's where supermarkets came about. Here on the East Coast, mostly on Long Island and in the city itself, directly after and slightly before World War II. So there I am, working in a cheese shop on the Upper East Side of Manhattan in 1975, and it all began for me, and it was purely because I was fascinated by the fact that nobody in New York really cared about food or was curious as to where it came from and why its name was Gouda. And I began to think and think and think that, by golly, I could get happy if I just took this seriously and began to write about it and talk about it and try and establish myself as the authority about it. But I realized there was nothing available to a New Yorker that was really worthy of anybody talking about. Everything that was available to New Yorkers in the mid-70s was a rendition of the real thing. It was a version of the real thing. It was something made by a European company purely for export, not for European consumption, but was something that they could send out and make money on. And here we are in New York City, the leader of the free world, and there was absolutely no retail of high-end or artisanal virtue foods in those days. It was just whatever we got, what we got. You want to make something out of it, come on in, we'll sell it to you. All they sold was derivation cheese, derivative cheeses, none of the real things. There was no real Camembert, there was no real Brie. There were zero goat cheeses, except for Boucheron and Montrachet, both of which were in and of themselves completely phony. Those goat cheeses were made with frozen curd and powdered milk. They weren't even traditional goat cheeses. So I'm telling you, 100% of what we sold in those days, in the mid-70s, was fake. It was real cheese, and it was nourishing, and it didn't taste bad, but it didn't taste good. It had no authenticity. It was made by machines from dead milk, and that went on for 20 years. And I spent that 20 years from 75 to 95 railing against mass production and railing against pasteurization and screaming about things in my shop that weren't real. And I was selling them right along with everybody else and being a big mouth about how phony it was, everything is that I sell here at this particular cheese shop.
New York City was a far cry from Steve's hometown in Missouri, but he managed to stay afloat and found himself landing a pivotal position at New York's beloved retailer, Dean & DeLuca, when they first opened.
And that was in 75. And in 77, I got an opportunity to work for Dean & DeLuca. I was the first person Giorgio and Joel hired when we opened that shop at 121 Prince Street in Soho in 1977, very hot July. And changed everything in the city and changed everything in my life, because I'd had a feeling that what I was trying to do was cool and was satisfying and was meaningful. But until I got to Dean & DeLuca and that beautiful huge space in Soho, the likes of which I'd never seen in my life, it became my joy. I loved going to work. And I was bringing home maybe $200 a week and didn't care, couldn't care less. My career just went on from there. I began to pioneer the cheeses that make life worthwhile. I just told the guys that were selling me all that crummy Scandinavian cheese, I said, here's a list of what I want from the French market. And I would list all the cheeses that I had been studying about in the Pierre Andruet book and the Patrick Rance book. And all I knew was that these things had pretty names. And I was able to attach those names to the places that gave their names to those cheeses. I wanted to know where the bad stuff came from as much as I wanted to know where the good stuff came from. This went on for a few years, and by golly, I would get these shipments that were just filled with all these, what we called in those days, fermier cheeses, farm cheeses. Cheeses that weren't made by a big factory, but indeed were made by people who for generations had lived in that particular area of France. And that's what they did. That's what their parents did. That's what their granddads did. And that was never done in the city of New York. Nobody ever got their hands on that kind of cheese. Eli Zabar did, because he was a hipster in the same time I was. This is what I wanted to specialize in, and I got it done. I got my hands on every great cheese there was that came out of France. At any given time, I would have 7, 8, 9 different Camembert. Véritable Camembert du Normandie, the real deal, the Moulet à la Louche Camembert. The moulée à la louche means hand ladled, molded by hand. Because when you make a Camembert, you're using a ladle to very gently scoop curd out of a vat and very gently deposit it into a colander-like thing that would become a flat disc of Camembert. But it was unheard of to have VCN Camembert, moulée à la louche, au lait cru, fermier, all of which was on the box top, all those wonderful little chipwood box tops, said it very clearly what it was, but nobody in the United States government knew any French. They couldn't read French. So they just let all this stuff pass through customs. Had they, at their GS7 civil service level, been required to intercept anything that was made of raw milk or anything that wasn't certified okay for export, I wouldn't have got my hands on any of that stuff. Everything I sold was illegal for years and years and years. So I just thought that was the coolest thing in the world. Not only am I a renegade and a rogue and a pioneer and a bandit, but I became a curator of the greatest assemblage of French and then later Italian and Spanish and English and American cheeses the world has ever known. I wanted to be like Europeans. I just wanted to be like a French cheesemonger. I would travel there, spend my own money, and I would hang out with those people day in and day out. And I got their trip into my DNA. And I brought it back to New York, and I was able to establish myself as the authority. I was the real deal. I'm one of those lucky people that found something to do that nobody else was doing, and I was able to take it to the max.
By 1980, Steve Jenkins left Dean & DeLuca and found his home at Fairway Markets, where he pioneered the exclusive importation of countless traditional foods from over 100 European companies.
You think about Fairway, you've got to think of my stores, Fairway Markets, as being the Upper West Side, Red Hook, Brooklyn, and Harlem at 125th Street under the Riverside Drive Viaduct. We've got this great Fairway that we put up there in 1996, 1995. Those three funky urban stores are the essence, the quintessence of what you think should think about when you think about Fairway. And it's the product of a bunch of us, one of whom, me, has the European sensibility where it's funky and it's huge abundance and it's signage thrust into a pile of anything and sawdust on the floor and screaming and yelling. There's no genteel thing about Fairway. We're all yelling at each other and calling out things. It's a raucous, riotous, urban environment where you find the great food. We are world-class food halls in that our selection and our method of presenting it to you is as cool as it gets. And there's no Tamburini in Bologna. There's no Caravé in Berlin. There's no Harrods in London. There's no Fauchon or Etiard in Paris that can hold a candle to a great urban Fairway Market.
Having established himself as the leading authority on cheese in New York City, Steve Jenkins took on another challenge in 1996, writing the seminal guidebook Cheese Primer. Cheese Primer won a James Beard Award and is one of the most highly regarded books in the world of cheese for both professionals and amateurs.
The Cheese Primer was the hardest thing I ever did or ever will do, and it should have been a lot easier because I always loved the written word and I always was a reader. So it never was hard for me to imagine being able to write something. It never occurred to me that I was going to have to create that opportunity myself. It was like acting. I just expected people to line up and ask me to do roles in various plays. I expected people to call me and contact me to write this essay or write this article or write this piece for this journal or indeed, let's get you going with a book. And of course, that doesn't happen that way until a guy named Barney Karpfinger, who was a literary agent, came into Fairway one day and said, I want you to write the cheese book. You obviously know more about it than anybody else, and there is no cheese book extant. Do it. And it came about. I realized this is not going to be easy. This is insects of the world. This is you're writing a book where you're going page one, chapter one, you got ants. This is going to take a lifetime to get this done. And it almost did. And I had to leave my job at Fairway at 88 in order to get this done, or it never would have happened. It took 10 years from when I signed to to when it was published in 1996. And it was the hardest thing I've ever done. But I knew I had to get this book finished. And by God, I did it.
After having mastered and conquered cheese, Steve began to concentrate on olive oil. He left no stone unturned in his quest to bring the world's greatest olive oils to the States and his Fairway Market stores.
Back in the 90s, I began to want to be as brave and bold with olive oils as I had been with cheeses throughout the 70s, 80s, and 90s. The only olive oils that were available in the early 90s were completely phony, but I've been consumed with the nature and the providence of olive oil for a good 15 years now, and really heavily for the last 5, 6, 7 years. And it brings me great joy. Aldous Huxley said, if I had another life to live, I would spend the entire life painting olive trees. He thinks like I do. He thinks that an olive tree is the most beautiful thing in creation. And the alchemy of transforming an inedible olive into something that's so palatable, not just the olive oil, but indeed the cured olive itself, to me is a thing of wonder. It's much like, how can those squirrels and those Iberico pigs eat those acorns without curing the goddamn things? They're so bitter, like an olive. The glucosides in an olive make it just so horribly bitter. Who on earth figured out that if you soaked all those glucosides out, the olive would become a meaty substance that brought you great joy? Much the same as the guy who ate the first oyster, or the guy who figured out how to get watermelon cold. You come into a Fairway and you've got access to 14 different oils I import in barrels from families that I've worked up relationships with over the last decade or more that I stick with, even if it's a bad weather cycle and the harvest is not going to be very good or the oil's not going to taste the way it tasted last year. I've stuck with them. They're the same 14 families from Greece and various regions in Italy and various regions in France and Spain. That is the pride of the industry. And I import those unfiltered extra virgin olive oils in 55-gallon barrels that have to decant, or the olive will be so cloudy you couldn't really pour it out. And the result is the oil's costing about a third of what it would cost if you bought it from a fancy schmancy store that imported it in a fancy half-liter bottle with an expensive label on it. And you can almost palpably feel the relationship between me or Fairway and the people that, by God, own the trees and shake them to make the olives hit the ground. That's just never happened before. Our country has evolved into a nation of artisanal food producers so fast. It happens so fast, and it's so wonderful. And I've spent all of my energies and all of my partners' resources at supporting these people at the expense of supporting lines of foodstuffs that I could probably make a lot more money selling. So I've sacrificed over and over and over again in an attempt to support things that have the best flavor, things that look the best, things that are truest to their particular region here in America, to the people that have sacrificed in their own ways to make these things and try and make a living. That's what I find to be most important. I, at the same time, try and expose the phonies in our industry, the artisan that's producing something and then charging more money than will ever be paid for a quarter liter of olive oil, like that, those California oils that are astronomically expensive. And these idiot food writers praise them to the skies, when indeed the idiot food writer doesn't know anything about olive oil, doesn't have any business commenting about olive oil. So you have these faux artisans who are blowing themselves up and are being aided and abetted by food industry writers who haven't done their homework. So it's a circle jerk of people who are not qualified to be putting a product down in front of somebody and saying, this is authentic, this is worthy of you. We had a cheesemaker come through in the 90s that got so much publicity. He was the darling of all of these food writers. And his cheeses were just in all of these fancy schmancy shops all over the place. And they were horrible. And it turned out he didn't even make them in the first place. And he invented something he called wild ripened. And that took on this resonance with all these writers, and they wrote about it. And I exposed this guy for being the phony that he is. He's gone, and I hope he stays away. I've done this with a few olive oil people in California. I've done it with numerous people up and down the coast that try and insinuate themselves into the pantheon of virtue and respect in our business because I can smell a phony from miles and miles and miles away. And I often worry that only burnishes my reputation as being a big mouth. But I don't care, because if I'm calling you out, you know who you are, and you know you're a phony, and you know that I know you're a phony, and I'm not afraid to say it. And everybody else in the business is. So I'm often pigeonholed as being a negative person, but I feel very strongly about trying to protect you from those kind of phonies that come across and make a life out of something that really isn't there.
Steve Jenkins is no doubt a polarizing figure in the food world, but how does he see himself? What does he think people make of his eclectic style?
They would probably say he's funny because he's such an a-hole. And he doesn't filter things that he says through any kind of propriety organ. He says whatever comes to mind. He's a sweet guy, and he's a nice guy. Now, he's never done anything mean to anybody, but oh, what an a-hole. He just won't leave it alone. He gets high too much. He's a wild guy, but he's somebody I can trust. He's somebody that I know loves me. I know he'd be there for me. And he seems to be pretty smart. Let's see what happens. But till then, let's tolerate him. That's what I think people would say. What I do is the coolest thing in the world. There's just nothing cooler than being with people that you love to be with and laying out perfect food and enjoying it together. That's the coolest thing in the world. Sure, you can climb mountains and skydive and swim under the sea and do those things, but when you're with people that you really love to be with and you've got some really serious food to enjoy and share with them, I don't think there's anything cooler than that. If you can add in there that you've traveled to some exotic, wonderful locale to do that with the people you love and the foods that you love to eat, then that's the best of all worlds. You know, like you're in Sicily. You're in the northwest corner of Sicily at Capo San Vito. And it's a beach town, and it's paradise, and you're with people you love, and you've gathered together all the great things of northwestern Sicily, and you're sitting there together. That's where you almost get religion. If you would ever want to be religious, that's where you realize, my God, am I blessed. This is just as good as it can possibly be. And my business is wanting to recreate that over and over and over and over again, not for myself, but for the people that come into my stores. I want to create that wonderful feeling of being with people, having great food around in a great area. That's just nirvana for me.
Steve Jenkins currently lives with his wife Michelle and is still working non-stop to bring his customers the finest cheeses and olive oils the earth has ever seen. This program was produced by Aaron Fairbanks and Jack Inslee, with additional research by Leah Eden and Patrick Martins. In order of appearance, the songs featured in this program are Real Long Way to Go by Brothers NYC, I Love New York by Rectech, All the Time by Controller, Dope Springs Eternal by Rectech, Danger in the Snow by Snowmine, The Hill by Snowmine, Let's Not by Shadowbox, and again, Real Long Way to Go by Brothers NYC. Thanks for listening, and visit heritageradionetwork.org for all of our programming and more information.
Hey everybody, I'm Nick Layton.
And I'm Leah Bottoma.
And we're the hosts of Were You Raised by Wolves? Each week, we try to make the world a kinder, nicer place.
Well, that's the idea, at least.
I mean, we try.
Have you ever wondered what to do if you're ghosted?
Or what to do when a friend asks you to borrow money?
Or the proper way to eat Cheetos?
You know, the big questions.
So please find Were You Raised by Wolves wherever you listen.